Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org, check out all the other podcasts that are going on over there. While you're over at 1517.org/podcast, you can check out Hidden Streams, the new podcast featuring Chad Bird, a little devotional stroll through the Psalms. It's got original music, highly produced. It's not like this show that we're running here. This thing has got a lot of time, a lot of production on the back end put into it. So you should go check that out if you have not already. All right, Chad, it's time to close the door on Gideon and get into a real interesting and bad story.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, we left Gideon making ephods last time, leading Israel astray. The end of Gideon's story did not end the way his story began. A lot happened to Gideon between that beginning and that ending, and especially toward the end, things were not good. He collected those golden earrings, made the ephod. All of Israel went basically literally whoring, as the Hebrew puts it, after those idols, became a snare to Gideon and his household. Now, it does say, as you pointed out, that the land had rest for 40 years under the leadership of Gideon, but those 40 years were not full of Orthodox worship, where all of Israel was just completely devoted to Yahweh. We have this continuing, as I mentioned in the first episode on Judges, this continuing Canaanization of Israel throughout the period of the Judges. It waxes and it wanes, but it waxes a whole lot more than it lessens. So we're gonna see the seeds that Gideon was sowing come to full flower in the life of one of his sons in the next chapter. So, you know, it happens sometimes. You'll have a guy who does some bad things, some wrong things. And I mean, that in itself is not good, but you really don't see the true effects until the next generation, right? That's the way evil happens a lot of times. You know, some bad decisions be made, some sins committed, but then as time goes on and these aren't dealt with, then the next generation comes along and it's twice as bad. And if it's not stopped then, the next generation comes along and it's three times as bad. So we're going to see what happens in the generation after Gideon. Before we get to his actual death, there's a couple of details that are significant here because they are going to be part of the story in chapter 9 of Judges. It says that verse 29 is where we're at in Judges 8. It says that Yerub-Baal, or his name is Gideon too, but the names are alternated throughout this narrative, that he, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now, I will point out the Hebrew there for lived in his own house could be translated a little bit differently. In fact, it seems a little bit unnecessary to say he lived in his own house. I mean, what's going to live in somebody else's house? But the verb for lived is yashav, which can be translated as lived, yes, but or sit or reign. So given what we know about Gideon's story, the people come to him and say, rule over us, and he says no, but then he proceeds to act as if he's a king by multiplying gold, and as we'll find out in a minute, by multiplying wives and by engaging in acts of idolatrous worship. All of those were symptomatic of a lot of the kings later in Israel and Judah. So yeah, maybe he did just go and live in his own house, but it's also the possibility that there's a nuance to that particular verb that suggests that he was actually not just living in his own house, but he was ruling from his house.
Well, you're about to find out that he had a lot to reign over.
She did. Yeah. Yeah. So get this, 70 sons. Now, how many brothers do you have?
I am one of six kids.
That's a large family. It's a large family. I mean, that's a lot for one mom and one dad to take care of. But can you imagine? I can't even fathom this.
It doesn't even talk about daughters. I mean, it just says 70 sons.
Yeah.
And then just in case you can't, you're like, oh, well, this guy must have really been, he must have really believed in adoption. No, his own offspring. That's what it says. For he had, mm-hmm. and then maybe, so you have this crazy statement. he had 70 sons, his own offsprings, and then maybe the understatement of the Bible, for he had many wives.
Didn't see that one coming.
How many? It's got to be a lot, man.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a harem, let's put it that way. And that just kind of goes with what I was saying about verse 29. I mean, what did powerful ruling people do in the Old Testament? Well, they accumulated wives, right? The kings did it. And other non-kings who were powerful people, they did the same thing. This might seem strange to us in our particular day and age, but it was not strange whatsoever in this culture. Dude, that was one of the ways you kind of flexed your muscles, right?
Yeah.
You accumulated wives and had big families.
Well, dude, if he even had half as many daughters as sons, and that's just being conservative. I mean, typically you got a 50-50 shot here. You know, so if he has to say he like really made a lot of boys, so he has half as many daughters. That means he's got over 100 kids.
Yeah. Woo. Like, he lived in his own house. I'm assuming either that was a big house or he had multiple homes.
Like, I remember my mom sometimes would one of us would be in trouble and she would yell the wrong name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like she'd go through maybe 3-4 names before she'd get the right one. Like, How often does Giddy even know the names of all these kids?
I was going to say, if I had over 100 kids, I'd make them all wear name tags.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Would not be easy. So, but you know, if he had that many kids, obviously he had a lot of wives. So you would think, I mean, got a lot of wives. So let's say he has, I don't know, what's a good number? 20?
I mean, for 100 kids, they had a lot. They, you know, they're not rolling birth control. I mean, I know people that had 10 kids. I mean, all right, say he had 100 kids. Say he had 10 wives, even. Like 10 wives, each had 10 kids. All right, 10 wives.
There you go. Yeah, 10 wives.
That's a lot
kids.
Of wives.
We'll go with that number. Now, it seems to me that if you have 10 wives, you got plenty to keep you occupied as a husband
and
a father.
Way too much.
Way too much. But not Gideon. In addition to his 10 wives, he also needed a concubine. So he got one. He goes down to this place called Shechem, which we've heard about multiple times in the scriptures, beginning already back in Genesis 12. That's one of the first places, if not the first place, that Abraham stopped, built an altar there. We also hear about Shechem. Significantly, we hear about Shechem in the story of Jacob. Remember when his daughter was kidnapped, raped, right? And then two of the brothers, the two oldest brothers, they came up with this plan for revenge by having all the men of the city circumcised, kind of a treaty they were entering into. And then they went in a couple of days later when all these guys were in pain and killed everybody. Well, that was Shechem. So Shechem has a history. Well, for some reason, Gideon finds this girl in Shechem and decides that in addition to his 10 wives, he needs a concubine too. So he has a concubine. And this particular concubine is going to conceive a son who is the central character in the next chapter. It says he named him Abimelech. Now, let me say right now, because this is going to set the stage for chapter 9. Very often, names in the Hebrew Bible, and everybody knows this, Hebrew names are sentence names, meaning that there's a whole sentence behind the particular name, right? So Abraham means father of many nations, right? Eve means mother of the living. So very often names have this a sentence definition, if you will. Well, Abimelech is composed of, I guess we could say, three different components. Av is the word for father, just like Avraham, father of many. So Av is father. The Y on there, so Avi, is the first person pronominal suffix, so it means my. So my father, Avi is my father. And then Melech means king. So the name, I mean, there's a couple of different things it could mean, but chances are Abimelech is named by Gideon in such a way that Gideon is indicating by the name his own son bears that Gideon understood that he was actually, if not in name, certainly in function, the king of Israel. So Abimelech, his son, means my father is king. It's all about giving your son a name that redounds to your own glory. That's a great case in point there. We have other Abimelechs in the scriptures, but interestingly, they're all non-Israelites. So this kind of falls into that. So chances are this concubine that Gideon hooked up with in Shechem, she was probably not an Israelite. So the son is kind of half Israelite, half Canaanite, and his name means my father's king. So that kind of finishes out the story of Gideon. It says that he died at a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. What happens next, though? Well, we have three verses to finish out the chapter. It says, it came about as soon as Gideon was dead that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berit their god. Well, as we talked about before, you might get the impression that this was kind of a day and night switch, but it wasn't. Gideon already set the stage for this, and maybe Gideon held back a little bit of the idolatrous worship. It certainly kind of sounds that way for this particular verse, that if you thought things were bad when Gideon was alive, well, just wait and see what happened when he died. So they played the harlot with the Baals. Now, the second name there, Baal or Baal Berit, is significant. So as we've discussed multiple times, Baal was kind of the junior deity in the Canaanite pantheon. El was a senior deity, but Baal was a popular god. He was the god of the skies, thunder, those kind of things. He was the common god that was worshipped in the Canaanite pantheon. Now, Baal Berit is the word for covenant. Just let that sink in for a minute. The Israelites, of course, had been called by God out of Egypt, and he had made a covenant with them. He had made a berit with them at Sinai so that they were his people and he was their God. So when it says that the Israelites were not just playing the harlot with the Baals, but they actually made Baal covenant, Baal berit their God, this was like a double betrayal on their part. It was one thing, I guess this would be kind of like, it's one thing to sleep around, play the harlot with the Baals. It was another thing to actually marry the person that you were cheating with. That's kind of what happened here, the analogy anyway. So they not only made Baal their God, but Baal of the covenant their God. So a double betrayal to God. And then verse 34 and 35 finishes this out by saying, the Israelites didn't remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of their enemies. And they did not show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, to Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. So you kind of summarize this, no faith, no love. No faith in the sense that they were no longer believing and worshiping in Yahweh, the God of the covenant, and they didn't show any love. The Hebrew there is chesed, your favorite word, this covenant loyalty, this covenant faithfulness, this covenant love. They didn't show that chesed to the household of Gideon. And we're going to find out exactly how they did not show that chesed in the next chapter. So we met the anti-hero of this chapter a few verses before. This chapter, Judges 9, is going to be all about Abimelech. In fact, it's almost a standalone sort of story. You could take out Judges chapter 9 and almost take it out completely from its context, and it would be a self-contained story. I mean, it, of course, is helpful to understand the background here to get all the details, but it reads kind of like it's from a Canaanite textbook on their own history, because there's very little here that has to do specifically with Israel. This is a story of assassinations and fratricide, of the killing of brothers, and kind of how evil leads to the disintegration of society and trust, and how in the end you end up with a lot of death, a lot of betrayal, and people basically having to sleep in the bed that they made because they set this whole cycle of violence and betrayal up. That's what the story of Abimelech is all about. So Abimelech, the son of Gideon, he goes to Shechem. Remember, he's from Shechem. That's where his mom was. She was the concubine of Gideon. He goes to Shechem and he has a plan. So evidently he's grown up now. Don't know for sure how old he is, but he's a grown man, and he has hatched a plan whereby he's going to be able to gain control of at least this particular area of Israel. So he goes to his relatives, and he speaks to his household, and here's what he has to say. He says to the leaders of Shechem, "Which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Yerubbaal, all the sons of Gideon, which is better, that 70 men rule over you, or that one man rules over you?" And not only that, he has a second argument. He says, "Also, remember that I, unlike those 70 guys, I am your flesh and blood." So it's kind of a twofold argument. Is it better that you have to be under the dominion of these 70 sons of Gideon? Or would it be better if you just are under one particular guy? And then secondly, remember, I'm your flesh and blood, but these sons of Gideon are not. They're basically strangers to you. So he first goes to his household, to his mom's clan or family. And after he presumably convinces them, then they go to the leaders of Shechem and says, it says his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of the leaders of Shechem. And it says they were inclined to follow Abimelech because they said, well, you know, he is our relative. So that's kind of what the plan is so far. But of course, there's a big problem. Abimelech can't simply go in and say to his 70 brothers, "You know what? I'm going to be king and not you." First of all, he's not an illegitimate son, because concubines were, I mean, they were kind of part of this particular culture. And so even though they were like a farther down on the family hierarchy, if you will, they weren't considered to be illegitimate children. So he can't say that, but he's certainly not considered to be a full authoritative son like the 70 sons of Gideon from his regular wives. So instead, what he decides to do is to take him out. He's going to completely take out the competition. But he's not going to do this by himself. It says that the people of the town gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berit, from the house of this Baal covenant god. And Abimelech used this money to hire worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him.
This is the greatest description of people ever.
It is. Yeah. I prefer, I don't know what the other translations have. Mine has worthless and reckless fellows. The Hebrew behind worthless is actually empty. It's the same word that was used to describe the pitchers earlier in the story, where Gideon puts, you know, the empty pitchers that the torches go inside there. So these guys are reckless and empty. So it's just like, nothing to them. They're worthless. Worthless and reckless fellas.
Yeah. This is just like mercenary type guys, right? I mean, they had nothing to lose. Not just a ton. Probably no families. Nothing to live for.
Yeah. And the whole thing is insulting, too. We don't know. Of course, I'm sure that the market value of slaves varied a little bit during the course of time. But we're told back in Leviticus, for instance, that a male slave was worth 50 shekels of silver. So these guys' lives are cheap, because they're 70 brothers, and they give him 70 shekels of silver to take out these 70 guys. So each one of them is considered the value, 1/50th the value of a male Hebrew slave. So it'd be like me giving somebody 10 bucks and say, "Hey, I want you to go murder that guy." Yeah, so to me, he's worth nothing. He's worth, you know, a couple of cups of coffee. But anyway, that's what happens. So it's mercenary money, but it's also religious money. So the money comes from the temple of Baal-berit to do this. So Abimelech takes these worthless and reckless fellows with their money, each one with a coin in his pocket. And it says they went to his father's house at Ophrah, and they killed his brothers, the sons of Gideon, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Yerubbaal of Gideon was left because he hid himself. And all the men of Shechem and all Bet Millo assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar, which was in Shechem. So they, we don't know why they did it on one stone, presumably because that was just like the spot of execution that they chose. But with the exception of one, the youngest, Jotham, which we'll get to in a moment, every single one of Gideon's sons were assassinated. Some pretty brutal plans of taking over leadership of Israel. But that's what they did. So we got to figure out what's going to happen next. I mean, anytime a detail is dropped like that, like somebody survives, you know that they're going to come up in the story in a minute. And in fact, that's what we're going to find out next. So Abimelech, I mentioned, means my father is king. Jotham, who was the youngest son who escaped, who hid himself, his name, Yotam, means something like Yahweh is perfect. So there's even a kind of a contrast between these two guys. So they're half-brothers. They're both the sons of Gideon, one by one of his wives, Jotham, and then one by this concubine, Abimelech. So half-brothers, but they represent very different perspectives on what should be transpiring in Israel. So they went and told this youngest son, Jotham, what had happened. And Jotham, he's quite a storyteller. But he's got a good story that he's about to tell here. It's actually classified as a fable. You know, anytime you have like animals or plants acting in human sorts of ways, then you have a fable. I mean, just think of, right, Aesop's fables, right? Where you have these, a lot of animals acting and speaking in human sorts of ways. So this is classified as not necessarily a parable, but as a fable. And that's what he's come up with by which to communicate the message he has to the people of Shechem. It says he stood on the top of Mount Gerizim, which is right there by Shechem, probably because on the one hand, he would be relatively safe there. He'd be able to get away. And also because there were natural acoustics. We know from earlier stories, like in Deuteronomy 11, that when Israel entered the Holy Land, they were kind of to divide up, right? And then they were by the two mountains, one of them being Gerizim, and they were to pronounce back and forth the curses and the blessings of the covenant. So this was a perfect terrain for acoustics. So he's going to be able to be heard on Mount Gerizim as he speaks to the people of Shechem. It says he lifts his voice and calls out. And I'll read the whole thing so you can kind of get a feel for the way the story goes. He says, "Listen to me, O men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. Once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.' But the olive tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my fatness with which God and men are honored and go to wave over the trees?' Then the tree said to the fig tree, 'You come, reign over us.' But the fig tree said to them, 'Shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go to wave over the trees?' And then the tree said to the vine, 'You come, reign over us.' But the vine said to them, 'Shall I leave my new wine, which cheers God and men, and go to wave over the trees?' Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, 'You come, reign over us.' And the bramble said to the trees, 'If in truth you're anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon.'" Let me stop there because that's the end of the fable. We'll see how it's interpreted in just a minute. That's a pretty cool story. I mean, did he like kind of adapt an existing fable for this particular circumstance, or did Jotham come up with this whole thing on his own? Who knows? But it works so well with the situation. And we see this not just in the Old Testament, but the New Testament as well, right? Stories are used constantly in order to communicate the truth in just a different fashion, right? It doesn't matter if it's the parable that Nathan told to David about the ewe lamb and the visitor that came, or whether it's Isaiah who tells the parable of the vineyard that God planted, in which he did everything possible for it to be fruitful, and all it produced was stink fruit, or if it's the parables that, that Jesus told. I mean, all of these are different ways, whether they're fable or parable or proverb, or even apocalyptic literature. All these are different ways of communicating the same truth. And I mean, it works very well here. You've got basically four different propositions, the first three of which are rejected, and the fourth is what he goes with. So in it, as fables commonly are, there's a lot of ludicrous stuff that's going on here, right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, the trees are going to like come underneath the bramble bush. I mean, it's a ludicrous image, right? How are they gonna find shade underneath nothing but a thorn brush? But you know, the first three, they go to the olive tree, right? And the olive's like, no, why would I do that? And they go to the fig tree and get the same response, and go to the vine and get the same response. So the olive and the fig and the vine, and these are representative of the three great crops that are produced in the Holy Land. I mean, you've got figs, which are used as fruit and sweetener. You've got olives. Olive oil was used for everything. I mean, everything from like softening leather to anointing to laxatives to cooking with. I mean, all sorts of things is what olive oil was used for. So it's a very beneficial production of nature. Same with the fig. And then, of course, the vine is used to make wine. So all three of these have their place, their purpose, and it's a very good and a very fruitful purpose. Now you get to the bramble. What's the bramble good for? I guess Gideon used them.
That's what I was about to say. Gideon knows how to use bramble.
Yeah, right. But it's just a thorn bush. You know, there's no shade. So when they come to the bramble, having exhausted all the other possibilities, and say, "You reign over us." And the bramble's like, "Okay, yeah, yeah. If you want me to reign over you, if you want me to be a king, you are underneath me to begin with. And if you double cross me, then fire is going to come out and consume you." So that's the fable. That's the story. And we have to assume that this particular parable or fable was understood by the people to whom he was speaking. But just in case, he's about to, having told the story, he's going to give its interpretation. And that begins with verse 16. So this is still Jotham speaking. "Now, therefore, if you have dealt in truth and integrity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Yerubbaal and his house, and have dealt well and have dealt with him as he deserved..." It's kind of a long, convoluted sentence. It's almost like he breaks off mid-through. It's like he was going to finish saying something else, but there's this big break in between. So if you've dealt like with sincerity in Abimelech, and if you've dealt well with my father and treated him and his progeny as they deserved. Now we'll pick up the if-then part of this in a minute, because he goes on to say, "For my father, he fought for you. He risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian. But you have risen against my father's house today and killed his son, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of a slave girl, king over the men of Shechem, because he is your relative." So we had this big pause in the middle of this pronouncement, this interpretation of Jotham. So picking up then, if you've dealt well, verse 19, "if then you've dealt in truth and integrity with Yerubbaal and his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you." So in other words, if you think that you've done the right thing, if you've acted in sincerity and truth and everything that you've done, then okay. But if not, and of course they haven't, but if not, "let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Bet Millo. And let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Bet Millo and consume Abimelech." So that is that's his interpretation. That's his application of this particular parable. So the men of Shechem have to put it in an understatement, have chosen poorly. They've chosen someone who's is the equivalent in the fable of a of the bramble, of the one who is worthless, of the one who's actually going to work much more harm than he could ever work good. And he's prophesied, right, that what's going to happen here is mutual destruction. It's not going to be just the men of Shechem who suffer, but it's also going to be Abimelech who suffers.
I think it's shocking that he survives this.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he must have. I was trying to envision this. I'm thinking he probably and he had an escape plan. You know, he knew the terrain, and he put himself where he could be heard, but where he could get away real quick. But it's still amazing. Like they just listened to him, right? Because yeah. it's going to take 2 or 3 minutes to say all of this, and in those 2 or 3 minutes, a lot could have happened. He must have had him spellbound. That's probably what happened. So like, something. All right, we got to know what's going on here, right?
Yeah, because I mean, as soon as he gets done dropping this knowledge on them, he immediately just runs away, and he has to hide.
Yeah, he says he escaped and fled, went to some place called Beer, which just means Be'er means a well. So maybe it was just a well where he hid out for a while, or maybe it was actually a place called Be'er. But anyway,
probably went and lived in a well.
Probably did. Yeah. Lived in a hole in the ground. Understandably, right? I mean, if you've lost all your brothers and you know that this half brother is out for your neck, then yeah, you're gonna remain in hiding. So he says he stayed there because of Abimelech, his brother. So things are not looking good for the descendants of Gideon. And in more than one way, but you know this pronouncement of Jotham is it is a fable, but it's also a prophecy, more or less. You know, prophetic statements take all sorts of different forms. Sometimes they're just acted out statements, prophecies, like when Jeremiah walks around carrying the iron yoke to symbolize what's going to happen to them under the Babylonians. And when Isaiah walks around naked for a long time as a prophetic enactment of Israel being stripped down and forced into exile. So those are prophecies too. So this fable is a prophecy, a warning of what is to come. All right, so what's going to happen here with Abimelech? And in case anyone is uncertain about this, let me put this out there before I forget. Abimelech is not considered to be one of the judges. And if you go through the book of Judges, and you add them all up, Abimelech is excluded from this list because he's obviously is not one that was called by God or clothed with his spirit in order to bring about the rescue of Israel. Quite the opposite. He was like an anti-judge.
Yeah, he's the almost the exact opposite of a judge.
Yeah. Yeah, because he acts unjustly, right? And he brings about, instead of deliverance, he actually brings about bloodshed and assassination. And so he's kind of the anti-deliverer of the book of Judges, the anti-Christ, if you will, in the sense that these other guys were christened, they were anointed. Well, he's the anti-anointed one. Well, his rule over Israel was relatively short-lived. It says he ruled over Israel for 3 years, and God stepped in. It says he sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. I don't know that particular phrase is used elsewhere in the book of Judges. We do have examples of God sending, well, this could be translated evil spirit, or maybe just a spirit who was enacting like a God-ordained evil. It's hard to tell, but whatever it was, there's going to be some distrust and backstabbing that happens between these two parties.
Yeah, and you might not have to take this quite so literally as an evil spirit. So, I mean, sometimes, you know, you'll say, well, there's just like a spirit of disunity here. Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily, when we say something like that, we don't necessarily mean that there is an entity involved here, that we're saying that between two parties, there is bad faith has sprung up, right? This sort of thing, that there's disunity, there's distrust, there's bad faith, all of this kind of stuff. So I mean, we all know what this looks like. I mean, we've all seen this within relationships and stuff before, where things break down, and you're like, man, there's just like a bad vibe in that relationship.
Bad blood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we use all these metaphorically, so we know what we're talking about. Well, and so this plays out. It says that this was all done, verse 24, in order that the violence done to the 70 sons of Gideon might come, and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hand to kill his brother. So all of this is God's way of, if Abimelech was the anti-judge, then God is stepping in to be the true judge. He's going to pronounce the sentence, not just upon Abimelech for his assassination of his brothers, but also upon the men of Shechem for strengthening his hands, which is an Old Testament idiomatic phrase, meaning basically to help someone, to assist them in some way. So what they do, well, it says the men of Shechem, they set men in ambush against him, against Abimelech on the tops of the mountains. They robbed all who might pass by them on the road. So they have these highway robberies basically taking place during Abimelech's reign. And then we have another character that's going to enter the story, whose name is Gaal, who was presumably a native of Shechem. Gaal, son of Ebed. So he comes to his relatives. He goes into Shechem. And the men of Shechem, it says, put their trust in him. So we have now someone else coming in trying to take control away from Abimelech. So there's going to be kind of a coup attempted here. So as they went out into the fields, they gathered the grapes, the harvest, and they pressed the grapes. They held this festival, and they went into the house of their God, and they ate and they drank and they cursed Abimelech. So all these guys are getting drunk and they're going back home, and they're having this party / worship kind of service, which was not uncommon in the ancient world, because it's all happening in the temple of their God. And in the midst of all this, they're cursing Abimelech. And Gaal takes this opportunity. He says, who is Abimelech? And who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Yerubbaal? And is Zebul not his lieutenant? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him? Would therefore that this people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech. And he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. So it's more or less a setup where Gaal is going to try and take over. Abimelech's been king for 3 years, but Gaal thinks that he can sway the hearts of the people and turn them against Abimelech so that they put him in charge instead. I mean, this is all part of this kind of growing tension, all part of God's, the outworkings of God putting this evil spirit between them, where you have differing factions all struggling for power. You got Gaal, you got Abimelech, you got their rulers, and you got the people of Shechem. And it's all basically going into, as the story goes from here, it's all going to crumble around them as nobody trusts anybody else. Everybody's looking out for number one, and we'll have to finish up the story next week. But this is going to be the fruit of everything that they've done. Abimelech starts out in blood, and he starts out shedding blood, and he's going to end up with his own bloodshed.
Yeah, not a lot of good guys in this story.
No, they're not. Not a lot of good guys in Judges, period, right? I mean, we have like little brief glimpses of good on occasion. But in this particular story, besides Jotham, besides the youngest son of Gideon, now everybody comes out of this not looking good, but looking like, yeah, they're just out basically for power and for bloodshed.
Yeah, the argument is not, we have turned away from the Lord. We need to overthrow this guy and turn our hearts back and repent. And this is not the argument that is being made.
No, like everything's horizontal, right? There's no concern for God. I mean, the only way God is used is use his house for drinking and for boasting and for backstabbing. That's about the only way that that a God figures into this particular story.
Yeah. Well, that is it, guys. That is 40 minutes. We will be back next week with Abimelech's fate. We'll see how this all pans out. If you would like to support the podcast, if it's been helpful to you, you can do so by going over to 1570.org, go to the donate page. You can become a contributor. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. You make it all possible. Chad, I will see you next week.
See you then.